I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Welcome to Political Breakfast from WABE. It's another week. And of course, joining me are political strategists Brian Robinson and Theron Johnson. Welcome to both of you. How are you? Another week, another day. Gloomy day here in Atlanta.
Doing good. I know you're both dog people, and I hope your dogs are holding up a little bit better with the thunder and lightning than mine is. Mine, Asher's had a really bad July. I mean, firecrackers for July 4th.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the fireworks.
The thunder, which is really making him angry. He had surgery on his paw earlier this month. So it's just been a bad month for my dog.
Sasha's fine. We just got to keep her from jumping up on the counter when we're not at home trying to find food. So we've had to lock her up, unfortunately, a few times.
So it has nothing to do with the thunder. She's just hungry.
No, she's just hungry. So we're trying to keep her fit.
Just being a dog.
She wants a little bit more
food.
Just
being a dog. Well, guys, we're in the midst of fundraising season. It is, you know, election season as well. And the numbers are coming in. They keep coming in. And Brian, you noted something that piqued your interest this morning that you found kind of, I don't know, hilarious. Is that the word to use at this point when it comes to the race involving Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Yeah, what we've seen in the latest reports is that Marjorie Taylor Greene has raised around $10 million, and her Democratic opponent, Marcus Flowers, has also raised $10 million. Now, you know, as Theron will attest, this is virtually unheard of in a House race, particularly one that's sort of in a rural area. I mean, most of these races, particularly with an incumbent involved, maybe a few million dollars. To get into $20 million range is absolutely extraordinary. There's no other race in the state that comes anywhere close to that level of spending for a U.S. House race, not even the 6th District and 7th District races, which had highly competitive primaries. They didn't come anywhere near to the numbers of just one of these candidates. And here's what's so crazy about it to me is these seats aren't competitive. Marcus Flowers seems to have a lot of charisma and good camera presence. His ads are really, really good. And he has zero chance of winning this seat. It is solidly Republican. Democrats are pouring good money after bad. And, you know, fine, whatever. They hate Marjorie Taylor Greene. They want to express that in some way. That's fine. But they're not moving the needle. They're not going to win this race. They're not going to take her out. You know, and on the Republican side, people give to her despite the fact that she's perfectly safe. $10 million is a huge amount for an incumbent House member. And to her credit, one thing that she has done is distribute that money to other Republicans across the country. She's one of the single largest donors, maybe the largest donor, to the National Republican Congressional Committee, which supports Republicans across the country. So I just want to point out the absurdity of the entire thing. It just goes to show how detached from reality our electorate, at least the donor class, has become.
I respect Marcus Flowers' race, though, and how he is going about raising money. I mean, he's getting it anywhere and everywhere using, you know, social media platforms. Theron, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that, if you have any? Is there really zero chance on his part? Is this a big waste of time and kind of hilarious, as Brian indicated?
Well, it's definitely not a waste of time, because if you look at Marcus Flowers, sort of how he emerged on the scenes, I mean, he had what we thought was going to be a little bit more highly contested primary. I mean, he ran against some really good people, one being Wendy Davis, who's a friend of mine up in Rome County. I think she's a city councilman up there. And then he really had an innovative way of how he kind of merged on the scenes, Lisa. I mean, he came out very early with television ads. You mentioned I was getting emails from him raising money before I even knew what he was running for. And so you got to give him credit that he got through this primary and he definitely won. And what he's been clearly able to do by raising $10 million is go beyond just Democrats in Georgia. I think that if you really look at his disclosure very clearly, I would say the majority of people who are giving to him definitely want to support a Democrat either way. Two, I think they're giving to him because they really, really do not like Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. Or three, that she's become so toxic, she's become so high profile, I think people see her on television or see her on social media and they're like, well, who's running against her? I want to support that person. But I do agree with Brian that it is an uphill battle. It is not impossible, Lisa. Nothing is impossible in politics. But if I was a betting man, based on the demographics of the district, nothing that Marcus Flowers is not doing or what Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing, is that the numbers are just not there. It's an extremely conservative district that Republicans drew it the way that they wanted to basically send a very conservative member to Congress. But, you know, shout out to Marcus and what he's been able to do. He's got a great team over there, folks. He's raising $10 million. And so I think whether he is successful or not successful, that is a name that we're going to hear in Georgia Democratic politics in the future.
Yeah, he's really mastered TikTok as well. So impressive race, if anything, on his part.
But $20 million up there, that is rage giving, not strategic giving, which is, hey, that's part of politics today when you can give online to somebody you don't know, somebody who's not in your state. But it's just worth noting that it's extremely out of the ordinary what is happening up there. Yeah, and all this social media stuff, it's all really, really good. And, you know, Theron and I know the Democrat consultant who's doing that Marcus Flowers race. And I saw him back in May. And I was like, well, buddy, you don't have a chance of winning, but you got a great chance of getting rich. So congratulations.
Well, I'm not in the business of counting other people's money and success shaming. But, yeah, he definitely should make some money. But I will say this really quickly, Lisa. I don't think that the rage giving, people are not giving to Marjorie Taylor Greene because they hate Marcus Flowers. I think they're giving
to Marcus. I agree with that.
I'm just saying. Yeah. I'm not saying you're saying that, but I just want to make a point that I think Marjorie Taylor Greene, what really is surprising and Democrats would be better wake up, is that she is still able to raise $10 million with a confluence of Trump supporters, I believe, QAnon supporters, and people who think that she deserves money from all of the chaos and dissension that she's caused since she's been a member of Congress. And so to me, I do agree that $10 million that Marcus Flowers has raised is partly because of he's just been an outstanding fundraiser. And then I think he's capitalizing on her popularity with some folks. But Marjorie Taylor Greene, even though she's been through all of this stuff, Lisa, I mean, she's been called out on committees. They tried to censure her. They tried to, they tried to make sure that she couldn't qualify for her seat. And through it all, still able to raise $10 million.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Going strong there. We're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, talk about, a lot of people are talking about is that Georgia 2020 election fraud scenario still. Fannie Willis doing her job, Fulton County DA, trying to make sure all the allegations and all the players involved are investigated. And we're going to do a brief update when we come back.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/freechecking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
Welcome back to Political Breakfast. Touched on this a bit before we went to break, but Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has put Senator Burt Jones on notice, saying that he could face criminal charges for his role in the so-called Georgia 2020 fraud case. As you know, Senator Burt Jones is a nominee for lieutenant governor. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Is that alone gonna put a big dent in his race at this point?
I think it's a few things that we got to sort of unravel here. So let's start with Fannie Willis. Fannie Willis basically became the district attorney of Fulton County because she got bipartisan support. She beat a longtime incumbent. Paul Howard had been there for a long time. And quite frankly, the people of Fulton County wanted someone new. They wanted a new direction, and they chose Fannie Willis. And the reason I stress the bipartisan support, because it leads me to my next point. So now, all of a sudden, when this district attorney that has been praised by a lot of people, particularly Republicans and Democrats, but a lot by Republicans, when she announced, you know, over 6 months ago, Lisa, that she was going to be investigating this case, many of us had a sort of a mixed reaction. One, we were very happy that she was number one doing her job, and that clearly there was some there as far as what former President Donald Trump tried to do to get Secretary Raffensperger to overturn our democracy and to basically go find 11,000 plus votes. But what she also said in that investigation is that she's not just investigating the Trump call. She's investigating all of the people who were involved in the process after the election results were in. And that includes all of the electors who are there. So I just want to start there. So the second thing I want to point out is that Fannie Willis is not just investigating Trump, and we see that with her subpoenas. She's investigating a large group of people. Particularly, she's now turned her her investigation to numerous of what she believes may be some faked electors. And so it's not just Lieutenant Governor candidate Republican nominee Burt Jones that she's investigating. She's investigating a lot of people. And the last thing I would say is that there are a lot of people trying to connect her to Charlotte Bailey. And I think if she was on here right now, and we've had Charlotte Bailey on this podcast, they have a relationship. She clearly supported him for lieutenant governor. And I think they work together in the district attorney's office. And so the thing is that I want to just also clarify that she began this investigation almost a full year before Charlie decided to run for lieutenant governor, because we may remember Charlie essentially wanted to run for attorney general first, and he switched to lieutenant governor. So I'm not surprised that news outlets like the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and others are starting to pick up on this. And I've been talking about this investigation for a long time, because it's really some very, very, I believe, damning evidence that's there, that there could have been an attempt by some electors to appear as fake electors and to try to overturn the election. So Charlie Bailey right now, Lisa, has got to figure out how he can, you know, get some earned media, because Burt Jones, who is someone that I've grown to develop a pretty good relationship with, Brian, he reminded me a couple weeks ago that he told me he was going to win the primary against Butch Miller, and he was right. He told me that, and he won. It was a very close election, and we've disagreed publicly on a couple of things, but particularly his efforts previously to try to take the airport away from the city of Atlanta. But when I look at the fundraising numbers, I mean, Burt Jones has raised a significant amount of money. And we were just talking about money before we went to the break. And so at a time where Charlie Bailey is trying to restart his campaign, he spent a lot to beat Kwanzaa Hall in a runoff for the Democratic nomination. He's got to figure out a way to generate some earned media. And he's got to figure out a way to generate this earned media in a way that kind of maybe puts a lieutenant governor candidate that really, quite frankly, wasn't really hit that much in the primary, and that a lot of people don't know a whole lot about, not because he hasn't been effective. I think this is his first time running statewide. So I think it's an earned media play there for him to kind of set up a framework to try to debate and put Burt Jones in a position where he's going to have to answer some of these serious allegations. And I want to be clear to our listeners, you know, he has not been accused of anything. This is an investigation. So you're innocent until proven guilty. But I do think that because he now is the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor, a lot of focus has been put on his, what we may or may not know, involvement into this electors process.
Yeah, Charlie Bailey is already talking and using this, as some ammunition. So, Brian, let me ask you, do you think he's going to benefit in the long run from all of that?
You know, part of the issue they face, and Theron touched on some of this, is if you're looking at Republican and independent voters, Republican voters are going to ignore this as a partisan witch hunt. Why? Because not too long ago, Fannie Willis was at a fundraiser, maybe even hosting a fundraiser for Charlie Bailey, Burt's opponent. And she also had appear before the grand jury, Brad Raffensperger and Chris Carr. Well, Chris Carr is running against Jen Jordan, who has appeared at news conferences with a political bent with Fannie Willis in recent months. So Republicans have plenty of ammunition to call into question the objectivity of what the district attorney is doing. And Theron's right. The district attorney does have some bipartisan support that does come from the fact that she was running against Paul Howard, who it just sort of offended so many people that he mobilized people against him by the indictments against those police officers back in 2020 in a highly politicized fashion. So, yeah, she has some goodwill. Can she maintain it moving forward? She's got to look unbiased. She has to look objective. And Republicans have a legitimate line of attack here to undermine the credibility of these charges. Now, you know, Theron mentioned that Burt Jones won the primary, and he won it by about 200,000 votes. He has raised a lot of money. He's able to self-fund, comes from a very wealthy family. And his family is in businesses that have a lot of donors, the convenience stores, the insurance business. These are sort of the base of their fundraising, and it's statewide. And these are people who can stroke very big checks. Charlie Bailey is not going to have that advantage. And the other problem that Charlie Bailey faces is he's running for a worthless office. If Burt Jones wins, he will be the operative president of the state Senate. He will appoint committee chairs. He will decide which bills go to which committees. If Charlie Bailey wins, he will be a figurehead in a Republican Senate stripped of any power. He will not appoint committee chairman. He will not decide what bills go to which committees. He will just have an office and a rostrum and a gavel. I mean, it's an act. It's the Queen of England, essentially, will be the job with much less fanfare than what the monarch gets. So who's going to want to give to a lieutenant governor? I mean, struck a $5,000 check, a $2,500 check to someone who can't help you. If you have an interest in a insurance issue and a public safety issue and an education issue, Charlie Bailey can't help you even if he wins. Why give money to him?
So if I can respond to that really quickly, Lisa, Brian remembers this because I think that he was actually either in the governor's office or had just finished Governor Deal's campaign when some of what he just described actually happened to former Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. I wanted to our listeners, like, don't believe the hype that you remember that, Lisa. Like, so Casey Cagle comes.
Where is Casey Cagle?
Yeah, good old Casey Cagle, man.
Casey Cagle today.
He's a part of that Gainesville mafia, and when I say mafia, I don't mean that they're an organized crime unit. But Brian knows that there's a Gainesville mafia. If he wants to talk about the Atlanta machine, which I never really deny or confirm. There is a Gainesville mafia. So, Lisa, he's doing just fine in Hall
Cagle
County.
Casey
Cagle, Martha Zahler, Nathan Beale. He's honorary. Yeah. Guys, there is a Gainesville mafia.
Absolutely.
But, yes. No.
I don't meet the wealth threshold for it, but that's why I'm just an honorary man.
Well, you know, sorry, Governor Deal. I know you listen and Brian updates you. I'm only just calling balls and strikes. But, no, real quick. So yeah, majority of what Brian just described is what happened to Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. His own colleagues stripped a lot of that power that Brian just described away from him. So my pushback on that is that no, there's no guarantee that that's going to happen to Charlie. Now it's highly likely because if the Republicans keep control of the Senate, they're going to want to dilute the power of the Lieutenant Governor. But I'm hearing, you know, when I say that, Lisa, I'll be talking to my Republican sources, just like Brian talks to his Democratic sources, is that there were a lot of people who did not support Burt Jones, right? Because he was running against a very credible, likable, respectful leader in Butch Miller. I mean, Butch Miller has been good to me. I have called him my friend on numerous shows. He told me one day that I talked about his sons and you know, and working with him, he said, that, you know, his wife was very appreciative of some of the things I said about him. So what Burt Jones has been doing lately, to Brian's point, he's been consolidating this Republican base that was sort of split. But the same thing that Brian just described that could happen to Charlie Bailey, it could happen to Burt Jones. Now, it may not be as significant, but depending on how this election goes, I can foresee him sort of getting a lot of pushback maybe from his caucus. Now, he is going to be able to reward a lot of these state senators who's been loyal to him. But there are some that are waiting to see what happens. And so I just think that this investigation, because we got to call it what it is, because I know Senator Jones is very specific about not being sort of proven guilty before he goes through an investigation, is that Fani Willis is doing her job. This is not a partisan attack. It is not her fault, Lisa, that there were only Republicans, Trump loyalists, most of them, who decided to go and maybe or maybe not participate in a fake electoral illegal process. So that you can't blame that on her. And I do believe that if there were Democrats who allegedly did the same thing that Republicans are accused of doing to try to overturn our democracy, to try to overturn an election, I think you would see the same manner and behavior in this investigation from District Attorney Fani Willis.
I think that this is a moment where it's worth looking at the position of Lieutenant Governor under our Constitution, which is a very flawed system. It has no constitutional power. They require on the rules of the Senate to give them power. And so you could run statewide, have the mandate of a statewide victory, and have no authority whatsoever over legislation. They don't have a vote even presently. So I think we need to take a look at whether or not we need that position. Maybe it can be like the House, where the Senate President Pro Tem is the de facto Lieutenant Governor, the president of the body. But this is just it's silly to have a Democrat as the head of a Republican Senate. And it will be Republican Senate. There's no doubt about that. After this election, will remain Republican. So I think looking at some structural reforms there would make a lot of sense. And let's also touch base again on the grand jury issue and what she's doing with the quote unquote fake electors, of which Burt Jones was one of them. Now, we know in Georgia that a majority of the general election electorate is against Stop the Steal. If you're a Stop the Steal person, that is a net negative for you in a general election. We saw it with Warnock and Ossoff. That was two of the major reasons that Loeffler and Perdue lost. Georgians rejected that. And then we saw it in the primary. Republicans rejected it, giving Brian Kemp and Chris Carr and Brad Raffensperger mandates with those wins. So, you know, that is an issue that Burt's going to have to deal with. It's a net negative for Republicans, and he is aligned with that. But what I would push back on is, was a crime being committed? They had a meeting, and their strategy, and I was, you know, I'm not part of this, I'm not affirming it or supporting it, but their strategy was, if these electoral votes get thrown out, we need to have this other slate ready, already done, so that Congress can acknowledge that slate of electors. That's not what happened. So it ended up not mattering. So it's sort of like, let's say you think it's a crime. Okay. The crime was never actually committed, right? Because the electoral votes as submitted by Georgia were accepted.
Lisa, if you don't mind, I want to ask Brian, a fair question. And this is what I think I've heard at some talks in the Republican circles, is that will this be a distraction? Will this be a distraction to Governor Kemp? Will this be a distraction to Herschel Walker and other Republicans who are running on down ballot races? Because you don't really see this bubbling up of a possible, you know, huge magnitude against a member of the Republican team that's running statewide. So do you think this is sort of could he be a liability, or could this be a distraction for the entire GOP ticket?
I think it could be an issue if the Democrats put some of their mountains of cash behind this message, right? I mean, we know Democrats have a massive fundraising advantage here in this election, up and down the ballot, other than the lieutenant governor's race. So that's sort of the interesting little caveat here, right? In the lieutenant governor's race, where Charlie Bailey is going to have trouble raising money for the reasons that I explained, and Burt's going to have a huge fundraising advantage for the reasons I explained. Where is the money going to come from to define Burt Jones on this issue? Is it worth Stacey Abrams doing it when Brian Kemp is so well-defined already as someone who stood up for our election? Is it going to be something that Raphael Warnock goes into when it's not something that is a hit on Herschel Walker, because Herschel Walker wasn't involved in any of that and has said sort of distanced himself from the Stop the Steal stuff? So it all depends on what Democrats do. You know, I don't think the Stop the Steal message is a winner here. I mean, I'm very clear on that. But do Democrats have a strategic reason to go on that territory in a race where their donors aren't going to care about it, where even if they win, who cares? Can they hit Kemp and Walker with it? And I don't think they can. Is that fair? Does that make sense?
And, you know, Theron, you use an interesting word, distraction. And what I was going to ask you, Brian, is what is all of this doing for voter fatigue? I mean, it's easy. You guys live and breathe this, and it's easy for you to navigate through all of this. But it's this investigation is launching the 2020 election back into the spotlight. We have this all-important 22 election ahead of us. What is this doing for the average voter in terms of fatigue and sorting through this and navigating through all of this?
I think the fatigue is very real. I think we all can agree on that, no matter what your partisan flavor. You know, Cassidy Hutchinson's bombshell testimony in the January 6th committee was watched by 13 million Americans, whereas the Watergate hearings were watched by the vast majority of Americans. They're not tuning in. Now, one thing that's interesting here about January 6th committee is Americans, though they're not watching it, they're aware of it, which in this day and age is very rare, that, you know, stuff that those of us in political circles just see as make or break, Americans aren't paying attention to. So I don't think that, I do think voters are tired of hearing about 2020. They're going to tune it out. Even I mean, I live and breathe politics. I just don't want to hear another word about 2020. I'm just done with it all. And so I think we're all just ready to move on. And I think that's going to undermine that message, that line of attack, unless Burt Jones or others go out and keep talking about it, which I can't imagine. I mean, the polling's got to be really clear on that issue. So I don't think you're going to, even in the primary, you didn't see Burt talking about it too much.
I don't know. I asked you the same question, Theron. Is the water getting too murky for the average voter right now?
Well, I'll be straight up with you. I'm very concerned about the lack of enthusiasm and participation amongst Democrats. Lisa, I am talking to a lot of people. I do that for a living. But I'm trying to really get myself in circles with people who are just not in a bubble like me, you, and Brian. I mean, you know, you report the news successfully and do a great job of it daily. But Brian and I, we eat, sleep, breathe politics. And I would just tell you this, and I'm probably going to upset some of the people that are on the ballot right now. But, you know, that's what I do. They're not paying me, so I can say whatever I want to say. Lisa, it's not just fatigue. It's also a distrust in government. And I think a lot of Democrats that I talk to do not believe that government is available to them the way that they need to. Because here's the thing, two scenarios. If you ask people, what do you think about the economy? The majority response that I get, Lisa, is that, oh, the economy is bad. So then I remind them, well, did you know that Joe Biden just had a June's job report where we had more jobs created than before pre-COVID any sort of month? And they're like, oh yeah, that did happen. But then you ask them, well, how are you doing? And the majority of people we talk to, Lisa, even the people on this podcast, including our boy Christopher, shout out to Christopher, who does a good job of keeping us in line every week. I don't want to speak for Christopher, but I think Christopher, Lisa, and Brian, and myself, we're okay, right? So it's this disparity that, yes, inflation is up. Brian wants us to think that the world's coming to the end because of gas prices. And he talks a little bit about guns, but he definitely focuses on the gas prices. And that's what Republicans should say. But if you really ask average voters and people in Georgia and how they're doing, the majority of them, not all of them, say they're doing fine. So Democrats, we've got to create a level of excitement about our candidates. We've got to create a level of excitement about what Biden has done. I mean, I can go through a litany of things that he's done since been in office, but unfortunately, it's sort of overshadowed by a host of other things. So I'm concerned about fatigue. I'm concerned about the lack of money that's being spent with vendors here in Georgia to create that excitement that we need on the Democratic side. And you can't just do it with TV ads, radio ads, and digital. And I'm in that business too. There's got to be a ground game. And lastly, I'm very concerned about black men. I'm getting a lot of calls about black men feeling like, are the candidates talking to me? I mean, I think let's just start Warnock. Warnock is talking to us because Warnock is a brother and he's a part of the same fraternity that I'm in. He's not only an Alpha Phi Alpha member, shout out to the bros, but he's also a member of the Baldhead Brother Committee. And he's a, he's a guy that we identify with, right? It's black men. So clearly he checks that box. But everybody else on the ballot, they better start spending some money and some time directly talking to black men, not just like me, who Brian likes to say are moderate, black men. And I do hang around business. A lot of those. Yeah, pro-business. I am. I'm pro-business. I'm moderate Democrat. But, if we don't start spending money and time and our resources and efforts talking to black men, Lisa, I'm a little concerned.
Brian, you agree?
No, he's dead on right. And, look, the front page, the cover article of The Economist magazine this week is Wake Up Democrats. And it's about how they're coming to realize that the progressive wing has become the voice of the party, the face of the party, and it doesn't reflect their own coalition. In America, particularly in Georgia, where we have one of the highest black percentages of the population in the country, the black voter part of the Democratic coalition is the most moderate part of the coalition, as well black voters and Hispanic voters. And what's happening with Hispanic voters? They are abandoning the Democrats in droves. Biden won them by like 40 points. I mean, it's just some huge. And now it's 50-50. Just picked up a Latino district in Texas with the first ever Mexican-born member of Congress, a Republican woman. So look, what Theron's getting at is the movement of black men toward other options. Now, I'm not saying they've become Republicans, but they're voting for Republicans. I would say Brian Kemp's going to get double digits with black men in this race. And certainly Herschel Walker will too. He's another black man. But Raphael Warnock definitely has to stem the bleeding with those groups to maintain the small lead that he's got in the polling right now, which, hey, kudos to him, right? To have a lead in polling at this juncture, in this environment, shows that some things are going his way, and he is implementing, he is strategizing, executing something well. And so giving credit for that, to be up in this environment is a big win.
You think black men, Theron, would go as far as to gravitate towards Brian Kemp as opposed to Stacey Abrams?
Yeah, all right. In the famous words of Lee Corso, and I was with Desmond Howard this weekend, Lisa. I was fanboying over Desmond Howard because I watched College Game Day on Saturday mornings. But in the famous words of Lee Corso, not so fast, my friend. I'm not suggesting that. And that's why Brian get pays the big bucks to spin. And Jovita used to tell us that all the time. And still can't believe she's gone, but it's very sad.
Oh, rest her. Oh, my gosh. Every time I see her.
Yeah, sorry to dampen the mood, but I just thought about that. She would always tease me and Brian and say, oh, y'all guys who just spin.
Always.
No. I'm not saying that, Lisa. No. You're not going to get me in trouble with Stacey. What I'm saying is, and Brian knows that I spend a lot of time looking at the stats. I believe that Brian Kemp roughly got about, I think that Stacey Abrams got about maybe 86, 87, maybe 85% of black men vote in 2018. Now, I think that she will get that number and higher because the demographics are on her side. We've seen more black men move into the state of Georgia since then. And I think a lot more of them are registered to vote. But what Brian is getting to, which I want to push back on, is that even if Governor Kemp, and I can't call him BK, a couple people called that on Friday too, by the way, Brian, is if Governor Kemp can keep that 10, 11, 12, 13% of black men vote, then is that the difference that Stacey needs to make up? So, which is why I'm imploring her and other Democrats to say, hey, we can't, if we can keep Brian Kemp out of the double digits with black men, that would be great. But Lisa, here's the X factor. Herschel Walker. I've kind of pulled back a little bit. I've been told by one of my mentors that you beat up on Herschel pretty bad. And, you know, why are you coming off like an elitist Democrat? And my mentor, who we know, who's been on this show before, he was right. But with having a black man like Herschel Walker on the ticket, what do Republican voters do? And there are some black male Republicans in Georgia. Are you more compelled to vote for Brian Kemp if you voted for Herschel, if you're a Republican voter? And I think the answer to that question is yes. But do you go in and vote for Warnock? And then who do you vote for governor? Is it Brian Kemp or is it Stacey Abrams if you're a black man? So to me, I think what the Republicans are banking on, and Brian just laid it out. And again, wake up, Democrats. Republicans are, it's very simple what they're doing. They're trying to get the disaffected white woman, college-educated suburban woman that I talk about all the time. They're trying to get her back, them back. They're going after Hispanic voters with their money. They have a very qualified and attractive Hispanic Republican on the statewide ballot for insurance commissioner. And they are trying to pick off black men. And the way they're doing it is that they are going to try to say, not necessarily like Trump said, like, you know, what do you have to lose? But they're going to try to appeal to the economic hearts of black men, meaning, you know, okay, look at what Democrats are saying to you to how do you can make money versus what Republicans are saying. So that's why I'm saying this in July, Lisa, because I don't want to wake up in November and we on this show, and I don't think this is going to happen, but I don't want to say, hey, Theron never talked about this. All of a sudden he's got these, you know, cheap seat ideas about why we lost. I'm saying now it's Hispanics, black men, and disaffected college educated suburban white women. That is the key to our success in November.
One voice that's clearly missing, and I would love to hear in this conversation, would be Herman Cain, the late Herman Cain. I'm sure he would have some really strong thoughts about the black male voter in
Absolutely.
Georgia right now.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I was thinking about him this morning. Odd you would bring him up when I would just have him on my mind. You know, Theron made some great points there that I think are very accurate. And there was an Axios piece last week that showed some polling that, you know, over the last 10 years, the group that has moved toward the Democrats has been those white college-educated women that Theron keeps talking about. And they've moved in dramatic numbers. And they have made an impact in Georgia. That's probably what gave Biden his winning margin and put Ossoff and Warnock into the U.S. Senate. And I'll say a lot of those white college-educated women in Metro Atlanta also put Stacey Abrams within striking distance in 2018. I mean, that was a really close election. We forget that now, how close that was. So at the same time, what's been happening, and it's not happening in tandem, so the outcomes are hit and miss, you're also seeing some minority groups who have been traditionally Democrat move to the Republicans. Like we said, Latino seats in Florida and Texas have moved to the Republicans of late. And you've seen blue-collar white people move from Democrat, labor-oriented Democrat voters to Republican in recent years, and that's made an impact in Georgia as well. And so one thing that Warnock's going to have to do to keep that coalition together, to keep the have a campaign that attracts those white college-educated women and keeps black men in the coalition, is he's going to have to create a Kemp-Warnock voter. I think that's got to be part of the strategy. They're not ever going to say this. And I'm not going to ask Theron because it'll put him in a terrible position. You know, I'm not, so he doesn't need to comment on this. But if the polling that we saw last week that shows Kemp with a healthy lead and Warnock with a slight lead, if that holds, then Warnock's got to have Kemp-Warnock voters. And that's going to cause some tricky, tricky internal politics between those two camps, which are aligned. Abrams obviously recruited Warnock for that seat and has been a major supporter of his. They are brothers in arms, essentially. And so this could create a little bit of tension over there on that side.
Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and most recently a senior advisor to the Biden Georgia campaign. Good to see you both. Have a great week. We'll do it again next week.
Great. Thanks, guys. Good work.
And Lisa, I just want to remember Congressman John Lewis, who would have been 82 this past week. And on past Sunday, we celebrated his life and legacy, but he passed away on July 17th.
He sure is missed.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.